and welcome to Season 3 of The Century Plan, a podcast that looks at financial independence, how to achieve it and how to maintain it during a lifetime that may see people born today living to age 100. With me, Dennis Hall, Chartered Financial Planner and owner of Yellowtail Financial Planning.
And me, Sarah Steele, Head of Operations at Yellowtail and Technical Controller on this podcast, here to ask questions on behalf of you, our listeners.
We're joined by Professor Sarah Harper. Now, there's so much to say about Sarah Harper, so I'm going to focus on the part of her work which led me to asking her to join us on The Century Plan. Sarah is a world-renowned scientist and Clore Professor of Gerontology at the University of Oxford. She's a fellow at University College and director of the Oxford Institute of Population Aging. And she was appointed CBE for services to demography in 2018. Sarah's written books, which include How Population Change Will Transform Our World, Aging Societies, Risk and Resilience, and Global Aging. Now, as you might expect, we're keen to talk to Sarah about how society needs to adapt to us living for longer and the way our increased life expectancy is changing the world and our retirements. But of course, if you want to know more about Professor Harper, then you can have a look at the links on our website. Sarah, welcome to The Century Plan.
Hello, thank you for having me.
Now, I wanted to know if you could just tell us about your career journey towards Director of the Oxford Institute of Population Aging. When I was listening to you on Radio 4, I heard that you'd studied anthropology and spent time researching mass retirement. And your first career choice was in journalism. So what led you to where you are today?
Well, I, as with most careers, what one sort of sets out to do often doesn't happen for all sorts of reasons. So I went to Cambridge. I read anthropology. I really enjoyed anthropology. I never once thought of being an academic. I discovered student journalism, which I really enjoyed. And it was then, just before I was about to apply for a variety of training schemes, when one of my tutors simply said, "Have you thought of doing a PhD?" Which I hadn't. And there was this wonderful opportunity at that time. I'd become very interested in migration to go to India and to work looking at the impact of those people who were left behind in rural communities when the young men went to work in the cities. And that was obviously women, children and older adults. Mm. Somehow the idea of spending another 3 years as a student was very attractive. So I went to Oxford. I did my PhD, did masses of student journalism, got into the BBC as a graduate trainee, loved being in the BBC and ended up as a producer on Newsnight. But having done research, I really missed it. And so I decided to come back into the academic world. And it just so happened that I knew I wanted to work on something to do with demography. I knew at that time that my PhD had been on migration. And it just so happened there was some government money around to look at the lives of older adults in relationship to the social construction of retirement. And the big question was, why do we have mass retirement? It used to be for health reasons, it isn't anymore. So I actually moved into social history and I did a postdoc trying to understand why did societies create mass retirement, which meant taking healthy, active adults out of the labour market, not for health reasons, but for other reasons. And then I just got hooked. I really, really enjoyed it. I had the opportunity to go to Chicago and I was a professor at the School of Public Policy at the University of Chicago. And there I worked in something called the Center for the Demography and Economics of Aging and thought when I came back to Oxford, that would be a wonderful thing for Oxford to have. And so I, in 1997, started setting up my own research center and it's now 26, 27 years on. So I was very fortunate. I had the right idea at the right time, I suppose, and some wonderful colleagues who supported me.
Well, I've got a question about aging population, but before I do that, what's a Clore Professor? Whenever we look that up on Google, all we get is your name or some Professor Clore in the US, and I am no wiser.
Okay, so I'm really honoured that the Clore Duffield Foundation and Dame Vivian Duffield who runs that, she is the one who gave me the money to set up the Claw professorship. So it was a personal endowment of my professorship, and that was in 2006. And so it'll soon be 20 years that I've held that title.
So the two, so the Claw Foundation and your chair are Claw.
Are the same. Yes, I'm funded by them.
Great. Okay.
Yes.
Just had to get that out of the way, otherwise we would have ended this conversation with me scratching my head.
Yes. Yes. No.
So we talk a lot about the aging population. It's one of the reasons why we have the podcast, to help yes. people financially through that. And the assumption is that we have an aging population because healthcare has got better. And I expect that's a lot of it, because that's the narrative we hear. But is that the only driver, or what other drivers do we have that is creating this situation today?
So I would say the aging of the population, until very recently, healthcare is the main driver, particularly adult, older healthcare. If we stand back, there are really two drivers. One is falling fertility, and that means that if you have fewer young people coming into a population, the average age of the population inevitably will go up. And the other is falling mortality, which means that people are living longer. So put those two together and your population start to age. But we've had this transition from a predominantly young to a predominantly older population in Europe for 250 years. And it's really what the demographic transition does. So you educate populations, you do increase their healthcare, but the first group that you benefit is actually younger people, particularly children, babies. You reduce maternal and infant mortality. And that means that more babies are grown, more babies are born and can grow up. And that is one of the drivers why women start to reduce their childbearing. They don't have to have 10 children, if they 10 babies. If they have three children, three babies, they'll probably get three children. If they have nine babies, they may bring up eight or nine. And so what we see is, first of all, there is a reduction in the number of children that are born, and then healthcare starts to increase its benefits across the life course. And you can see that very clearly, that, public health initiatives, sanitation, much better food, calorific intake, etc., all started to improve the health of the population. And so babies and children stopped dying, people started living longer. And then in about the 1960s onwards, geriatric medicine and geriatric healthcare came in. So it is true, over the last 20, 30 years, particularly in high income countries, it has been improvements in healthcare that has enabled people to live longer with the chronic conditions of old age. And I think that we still get those chronic conditions, but we live longer with them. And a lot of that's around pharma, to be perfectly honest. We now have the drugs that can help our bodies cope with cardiovascular disease, stroke, cancer, diabetes, etc. So healthcare is important, but the real aging of the population is far more complex than that. And it's to do with the general health of the population, and it's to do with things like education and public health initiatives, etc.
And I'll probably come back to that a little later, but we see this aging population, or it's perceived in the press as a negative. It's a problem that we've got to deal with. And I believe you don't see it quite that way.
No, it's an inevitability. It's something that is going to happen. It's very much happened in the high income countries. We have very low childbearing. And I think you do have to put the two together. We have very low childbearing. We have fantastic increases in longevity, increases in healthy life expectancy. There are still inequalities, even within a country like the UK. There are inequalities in both our life expectancy and our healthy life expectancy. But we also see now it's happening throughout Asia, it's happening in Latin America, and it's only really in sub-Saharan Africa where we still have high rates of fertility and mortality across the life course. But we project that even in sub-Saharan Africa, in the second half of the 21st century, they probably will also have an aging population. So it's going to happen. And the main thing is to say, well, we used to live in societies where we had large numbers of younger people and they died across the life course. Now we live in societies where we have fewer numbers of younger people, and we've got to look at the resources within our society. And in particular, we've got to ask about things like definitions of old age. Why do people look at people in their, well, I mean, if you talk to some of the banks, by the time you're 50, you know, you're old. And yet these people are highly educated, very healthy, and probably will be fit and healthy until their 80s, their late 80s in actual fact. So we just have to adjust our perceptions. And the idea that you're old at 60 or 65, for many people, particularly educated people who have had healthy lifestyles, that simply isn't the case. So if you look at it from that perspective and say, this is going to happen, and in fact, we've actually had many decades in high-income countries to deal with it, let's change our societies so that we can deal with this shift from the pyramid more to the skyscraper in terms of our population structure. And let's also step back and say, well, society is changing. Technology, you know, one of the issues that people worry about is that we won't have enough younger workers. Well, we definitely will have older adults who are able to work very successfully in a knowledge economy. We also have technology, because there's another argument that technology is going to take away jobs. No, technology will replace maybe some of those younger workers, rather than technology being seen as a threat or aging populations being seen as a threat. It's a matter of saying these are the trends and the drivers, and we need to ameliorate and modify their effects so that it becomes successful.
Yeah, and I know you had another question, but I've got one that's linked to what you just said, actually, Sarah, which is talking about the aging workforce, because, you know, we're talking about an aging population. Does it naturally lead to an aging workforce? And there was something that you had said before about the, how technology is aiding an aging workforce. And so we shouldn't see that as a negative in terms of people continuing to work for longer. There's different skills that creative skills, I think you said, that people in their old years have that perhaps the younger generations don't.
Yes. So in other words, I think there are so many misconceptions out there. One of the misconceptions is that older people, i.e. 50 plus, can't deal with technology. Well, yes. I mean, I'm sure 20, 30 years ago, we would have had people in their 50s and 60s, let alone their 70s, who didn't grow up with technology. Now, everybody is in their 60s and even in their 70s would have come across technology either at school or at university or college, and definitely in the workplace. And so we have a cohort that can definitely deal with technology, and we have to get away from this idea that all older adults cannot deal with technology. It is true there are still some people in their 80s and 90s who find some of the sort of hardware around technology, not really very user-friendly. That is a sort of hardware software issue, which engineers could definitely tackle if they wanted to. Probably there isn't money in it, to be perfectly honest. But the rest of us are very, very able to be able to work successfully in a modern economy. And there's really interesting research which looks now at how our brains change and how the different types of intelligence we have. And we've known for a long time that there is a shift from different types of intelligence. But now with brain scanning, we really can see how the brain changes when we think and create. And the basic sort of idea is that when we're younger, we're very good at something called fluid intelligence. And that's very, very quick-witted thinking. And a wonderful example of that is that if you play a snap with a seven-year-old, they will beat you every time because it's bam, bam, bam. They can easily do it. Lose that in our late teens, early 20s. It peaks around about 20. And then that intelligence starts to actually go. Across our lives, this what we call crystallized intelligence increases, and it really begins to peak 40 plus, so that between 40 and 70, and that is lateral thinking and creativity, thinking outside the box, adaptability. Some people call it experience, but it's much, much more than that. And if you look at the kind of skills that at the moment, new technology and particularly AI are good at, AI is good at sort of data processing and really gathering lots and lots of ideas together. It's not so good at thinking out the box, being creative. And in a knowledge economy, one can say that technology will replace a lot of the skills that younger people naturally have and a lot of the jobs that younger people naturally do. We're already seeing that. But those more complex jobs are the ones that it's going to take quite, I think, much longer to be replaced. And they're the ones that people in their 40s, 50s, 60s, and even 70s are very capable of doing. So if we put the two together, we can say that we have a healthy, active, older population. Education has been really important, but huge numbers of older adults now have definitely secondary school education and higher and further education. And so in a knowledge economy, we have people who are very, very able to work in that economy far, far longer. We're not talking about manual workers who, you know, were simply exhausted in their 50s. We're talking about people who are able in their 60s and 70s to continue working very successfully.
Yeah. And I know, well, that sort of addressed my second question in that regard, was whether we, and certainly in the Western world, are ageist in terms of our working population. You know, we have an attitude towards anyone, I suppose, as you say, from the 60s onwards, being able to cope with technology, to have the same level of value in the workforce. And really what you've just said is an argument against that.
I mean, I would say one of the real problems, and it isn't just here. I mean, look at a country like France, where, you know, that they're objecting to having to retire at 60. You know, their healthy life expectancy is one of the highest in the world. In fact, it is almost the highest in the world for women. Japan, France and Spain have, you know, very, very high healthy life expectancies, well into their 80s. And yet they want to retire at 60. And part of that is ageism. It's ageism from younger people, but it's also ageism from older adults themselves. And so I think to a certain extent, ageism and attitudes really are what are holding back the sort of development of an age-integrated society. Definitely when we've done surveys looking at retirement, it's very clear that, you know, even in people in their 50s and definitely in their 60s who feel able to continue in the workplace, quite often it is people younger than them and their peers who are sort of saying, come on, you know, shouldn't we be sort of, you know, on? But if you can sort of get rid of all that stereotypes and actually look at the individual, I think in the world we're living in, we should have choice. And if you ask many people in their 50s and 60s, they do want to continue. That, you know, they, I mean, the idea of retiring at 60 and living till you're 90 with absolutely nothing to do, which I think in the 80s, lots of people thought, this is amazing. Whereas, you know, many older people, they may not want to work 9 to 5 and commute into London or Manchester or whatever, but they do want to contribute and they do want to play an important role. And of course, you know, one of the other pieces of work that we're doing at the moment, which is looking at things like working from home, flexible working. Parents, people in their 30s and 40s who are parents, they want to work from home and have flexible working. People in their 60s and 70s quite often say, well, I'd love to continue, but actually I'd like a bit of flexibility in my life. So let's look at it from that perspective. And I think, you know, the jigsaw sort of comes together then.
It does. And, well, I advise many people who, there used to be a narrative that they'd want to retire at 50 or 55. By the time they get there, they don't. Yes. Some people do retire at 60 or thereabouts. And if they haven't really got a big plan for it, by the time they've done 18 months of traveling the world and playing on their toys, they're keen to get back into the workforce again in one form or another.
Yes.
But it becomes a bit more difficult.
Yeah.
There is an element of ageism
there,
particularly if you want to be employed by somebody or working in a consultant basis. But I'm going to throw something into the mix here, that people talk about one generation having a better time of it than another. And at the moment, I think it's the boomers that are getting a hard time. And I'm at the tail end of the boomer, and I don't feel as privileged as maybe some of those that might be 10 years older than me. Do you think that there is a real inequality between generations? Is there a generation that might be, and I've been reading something about that, perhaps the generation behind me is going to get skipped and the one behind them is actually going to reap some phenomenal rewards?
I mean, I for a long, long time, I have been saying, forget about the, you know, intra-generational war. And I'm sorry, a lot of this has been hyped up over the last 10 years and the press love it and the politicians buy into it. It's intergenerational inequality we need to look at. And now, in fact, I just, you know, this week, two articles came out, I think in The Guardian and The Observer, which were, or maybe even The Telegraph, actually, which were talking about the millennials and the inequality within millennials because of inheritance. Every single generation has good times and bad times, you know, and you only have to look at that generation, you know, who was born at the beginning of the 20th century. Look what happened to them. They were slaughtered. You know, and if you look back through your own life, I mean, I look at my grandmother, who, you know, she was in her 30s as a woman before she got the vote. Many of her friends died in childbirth. She, you know, the thought of her staying on at school was, it just never happened. My mother would have loved to have gone to university as a woman, but, you know, she was born in the 1920s and, you know, no way could she, you know, she go to university. I mean, I was very lucky that I was able, I mean, I went up to Cambridge, but when I went up to Cambridge, there were 8 men admitted for every one woman. If I look at my parents' generation, and as they say, my parents were both born in the 1920s, I think they were actually quite lucky in so much as they benefited from all that. They missed the wars, both wars. They benefited from all the public health advantages. So they had, you know, national health care, good dentistry. They went into work in the 50s and 60s. Okay, they went through the sort of time after the war. But then they hit the sort of property boom. And then when my father retired in the mid 80s, and he used to work for IBM, and he was an IBM pensioner for 35 years and an IBM employee for 33, which he was very proud of. So if you're going to pick a generation, they were pretty lucky. But so what? You know, I mean, it just so happened that they were living in a particular historical time and they benefited from certain things. If you look at my generation as a woman, as I say, I was really lucky. But I, you know, I have 3 children, and I was one of the few women of my age who actually had a career and was able to have children. I look at my daughter has just had her first child, and she takes it for granted that her husband will do a lot of the childcare and that she will go back to work. And definitely educated young people. All my children are millennials. They've just crept in. I have 3 children. They just fell into that. But if you look at the salary differential within that group, it is extraordinary. So I think the idea that, I mean, so if you belong to a small generation, then you can say there is less competition for jobs and marriage partners and housing and all those other opportunities. If you belong to a small generation with a large generation above you or below you, then you might say, well, resources are going to be diverted above me and below me, so they're going to be given to children and older people, etc. So you can slice the cake lots and lots of ways, but I think it's, you know, the inequality within generations that is increasing phenomenally in this country that is what we should be worried about.
That chimes with something that I was reading a book this morning just before our call where, yeah. Americans today that have, again, have probably never had it so good, look to the golden age for them being the 50s. But then you compare life in the 50s to life today, and average earnings were about half in real terms. Houses were smaller. There were more people living in them. They spent more of the proportion of their wages on food than they do today. It is changed, and yet they look at that as a golden age because life was simpler, perhaps.
Yes, yeah. I mean, what I find very sad is, and this is doesn't happen as much, but there was a time maybe 10 years ago, I would have young, highly educated women sitting in my office saying, we are the worst generation to have ever lived. And it was like, where does this come from? Look at you. You're educated. You travel the world. You know, your health is fantastic. Your longevity is probably very good. You can choose whether or not to have a child, and no one is going to look at you and in any way. You know, you can choose your sort of sexuality. You can choose your gender, etc. So socially and culturally and actually economically, you're not that badly off. And yet you have been told that, you know, the boomers had it really good and you're going to have it really bad. So I think the press and a lot of sort of, I don't know, I mean, yeah, sort of public writers have actually told a generation that it's really bad, and it isn't. You know, there are good and bad things. Depending on every year that you're born, people are going to hit good and bad times.
No, that's true, and it just depends what you choose to believe, really, doesn't it? And
yes.
Which press you want to focus on.
But on the other hand, as I say, if I look at my children, who were, you know, they were all educated. You know, my daughter is a teacher. Works in a sort of inner city school, and so it doesn't earn much money and really sort of sees that kind of deprivation. But if you look at people of their age living in different parts of the country who decided or weren't able to take advantages of education, they are living a very different life from many of the friends that my children have. And I think it's the inequality that is really worrying. What will happen to some of those children who are already experiencing deprivation at young ages or as teenagers when they grow up? Because at the moment, it's not going to narrow. If anything, it's going to get further apart. And that's what we should be worried about.
And I think it's probably easy for politicians to blame the generations.
Yes.
A while ago, I read a book by David Willetts called The Pinch.
The Pinch.
Yes, I know, which shaped a lot of my thinking for a while. You've read it, obviously.
I love David. I know him really well. I think it did shape this intergenerational sort of conflict. And I think it was very unfortunate. It was a novel idea, but yeah, I'm not going to say any more.
I was going to reread it, so maybe I won't.
Yes.
All right, well, shall we bring it back to retirement and pensions? Because that's what we're talking about on our podcast. But so I listened to you on Radio 4's The Life Scientific, and I was nodding along as I was driving along in the car. And you were talking about the state pension age being set at 65. And when it was set, most people were dying in their mid-40s. So they had very little chance of actually reaching this pension age. And you said, if you extrapolate that out today, given that half of our population lives to about 80, the pension age should be 103. Mm-hmm. Now, so on the basis of that and in light of that, do you think that the current state pension age is appropriate?
Yeah, that is obviously a fun story.
It's a good story.
Anyone is saying we should have a pension age, but it just shows, I mean, so society has changed. For a long time, people had no safety net at all. And then when the safety net came in, it really was pitched for those people who had staggered on and probably lived very sad, very ill health lives. And for just a few months, you know, and we are talking about months, probably rather than many years, the state would look after them. And that was also the case, even in the 1940s, when sort of mass retirement came in and we had a state pension. Again, they chose 65. And my memory of that statistic is that half of the population was dead by 69, 70. So we definitely do need, I think, in our society to enable people to have a period at the end of their lives when they can have rest, they can do something different, they feel supported. And I think we have that in place. Now, obviously, we're pushing back that age. So it's currently 66. It will go to 67 and then 68. One of the problems we have is that, yes, I think that works fine to go back to sort of educated, healthy adults. The problem is, not only in our country, but let's just stick with the UK, we do have a large number of older adults who simply cannot continue working to the end of their 60s. And furthermore, as you have inferred, there aren't the jobs there for them. And in fact, I mean, only this morning, they're talking about, you know, the UK labour market contracting, job vacancies going down. And obviously, older adults are not going to maybe be able to benefit from there being job opportunities. So I think a much more sensible way, and it's something that my institute has actually said on numerous occasions to governments over the last 15 years, is in a way we need to get away from this idea of a state pension age. People talk about Britain having a retirement age. We don't have a retirement age. We have a state pension age, and many people take that at the age at which they will retire. If we were able to move to a system whereby you had to contribute national insurance contributions for X number of years, let's just say 40 years, then you would have those people who left school at what is now 18, went into a job which maybe was more challenging. And so by the time they were in their late 50s, they would have done enough years that they would be able to take a pension because they could have paid their 40 years. Whereas those people who went on to further education, went on to training, I'm thinking here maybe of sort of doctors, and they didn't go into proper employment, say to their mid-20s, if they worked the 40 years, they would obviously have to keep working until their late 60s before they got the equivalent of a state pension. And that would be a much, much fairer system. And it wouldn't actually be that difficult to operate, because all you would have to do is you have to say you have to pay a certain amount of contributions in order to get a full state pension. And obviously for women, for those who had caring relief or sickness, one would be able to supplement them in the way that you do, you know, already for women who are pregnant, for example. So I think, yes, it does seem that probably going forward, 70 will eventually be a new state pension age. But we do have to have either a different system whereby we say 40 or 45 years of contribution, and or we have to have a safety net. And at the moment, I would say what's very clear is that we did some very interesting modelling when I did the foresight review for the government, and we looked at England and Wales and men aged 65. And we compared those men who were living in the bottom three most deprived areas, 30%, and with the top most affluent areas. And if you were living in the bottom 30% of disadvantaged, a man at 65 would probably have a life expectancy that would take him to his late 80s, but all, sorry, his would take him to 80, but all his 70s would be in ill health. And there's no way he could really sort of work. Whereas if you look at the top 30%, those men would probably make it to their late 80s and they wouldn't go into ill health till they hit 80. So our 70s are really crucial at the moment. And I think the idea that somebody would retire at 70 and then almost immediately die or go into frailty is not something in our society we would find acceptable nowadays. But on the other hand, you know, we have to rethink the system to enable that person either, I mean, hopefully healthy life expectancy would increase, but if it doesn't, so that they can have a time in their 60s where they are supported. So it's not as simple as your question.
Right. It's not, and as you were talking, I was thinking about how people might gain that by using voluntary contributions while they're at university to start that 40-year clock ticking on their national insurance contributions.
No, knowing students, I can't see that happening. But,
but they're wealthy.
What I mean also, if we didn't have a chronological age, people wouldn't be so hung up. And what is really interesting is that many, many people, I think at the back of their mind, you know, pension age is still 65. Well, it's not, it's actually now 66. And people, but 65 is when you become old because that's when you retire. Well, no, that isn't actually the case. So get rid of chronological age, and then we would be able to look at later life in a very different way.
That's very important. I was lucky enough to go to a cooking school in Puglia late last year,
right,
where they had invited a couple of American doctors who are really at that forefront. I think one of the guys is from Cleveland Institute. They're at the forefront of this aging question, where they're saying there are things that we can do today with health, with our diet and health, to improve our life quality and increase our lifespan. But some of the work they're doing on genetics that will take us from, I mean, in my financial planning, I assume people are going to live to 100.
Right.
Not many people will, but it would be, some will. So we've got to assume for that. But they're saying it will be fairly soon that 120 and maybe even 150 would be a reasonable lifespan to assume for people if we start playing with genetically. And in mice and rats, they've been able to do some of this work, but not on humans yet.
Yeah. So I would push back a little on that. And I would answer it in I don't think it was a question, but I'm going to come in sort of two ways. One, So the really exciting thing that has happened is, I would say, over the last 5, definitely 10 years, our understanding of what we call cell and society. We know that our environment and our behavior really affects our aging process, but we now understand it affects it at the cellular level. We can alter our telomeres, which is, if you like, a sort of cellular marker of aging or senescence, by what we do, what we eat, how we behave, whether we exercise or not. not only do we now have a really good relationship between diseases, so we know if we do A, we'll reduce our risk of cardiovascular disease, cancer, diabetes, etc., but at the cellular level, we can start tackling that. When you talk about food, the Global Burden of Disease study, which is a fantastic study, it showed that the changes in the diet can be phenomenal. So if an average 20-year-old American change their diet from a standard American diet to a Mediterranean diet, they would add 10 years of life. If an 80-year-old American did the same, they would add 3 years of life. It's quite extraordinary, you know. So getting rid of the rubbish food and eating healthily, and we all know how to do that, fruit, vegetables, proper grains, not ultra-processed foods, we really can extend our lives. When we come to this bit that you're talking about, I do think we are at the cusp, and I completely agree on one level with your medical colleagues, because what we're able to understand now at the cellular level, and it is true that we really are beginning to understand senescence. So in other words, we're understanding not only what causes the cell to age, but what is necessary for the cell to age, and also what is necessary for the cell not to age. And pharma is really buying into this. I don't think we're going to see, even in my grandchildren's lifetime, people living to 150 naturally, but 120, I think, will become the new 100. I would think this century, by the end of the century. So I think there is caution. I mean, I think you do have to be a bit cautious, and you have to also make sure that you don't take away from the fantastic increases in healthy life expectancy for everybody, which is what I think we should be going to. But we do really understand simple tweaks across the life course and in life age around diet and exercise can give us those extra healthy years. And then you are right, genetics, cellular medicine and pharma probably will give our children and definitely our grandchildren those extra decades.
It is, and I find that a very interesting topic. Mm. Diet, incredibly important. Exercise, yes. I think you've just touched on, because yes. What is it that sitting is the new smoking? We're all at very sedentary jobs.
We should all stand up now and walk around.
I should be doing more of that.
Yeah.
But it's incredibly important. Stress, I think stress was also an incredibly
important. Stress is important. And social interaction. So when you look at the Mediterranean diet, which is very clear, it isn't just the Mediterranean diet, it's also the Mediterranean lifestyle. And it's actually quite difficult in Northern Europe to do that. And I went to a conference in Valencia last year in May. I flew from sort of rainy Britain, where everyone was sitting inside, you know, on their computers or watching TV, to Valencia. And there, walking along the coast, this complete mixed generations every single evening. There were old people, there were young people, there were children. All the parks had benches and sort of these kind of exercise machines for older and younger adults. And the older people were really part of the community. It was amazing because they could get outside in the evening sunshine and they would either be with, you know, a family or they'd be with other older adults. They can do that in a way that it is more difficult in Northern Europe because of our weather, basically.
And I used to live in a village, a very tiny village in North Devon, up until recently. And we used to say it was like we were in hibernation during the winter. And it was, you know, sort of a mixed demographic in the village. And then we would all get together. We'd all see each other and talk to each other in the summer. And it was like two distinct seasons. Yeah. Then as well. So, yes, I suppose we can blame the weather for some of it.
Yes. Yes.
We like to. Yeah.
I could have gone several. I don't know where to go from here because we were opening up. This is supposed to be about finance and money. And I'm really interested in epigenetics and diet and food and all of those things that actually I read about all the time, which is really interesting. I saw a picture yesterday on Twitter. I can't call it X. On Twitter of this guy who was 64. But had all the markers in his body and the way he looked of a 37-year-old.
Yes.
And the hacks that he did to do that are all available to almost everybody at not too great a cost. There are some people that are now changing their blood through blood transfusions from their younger children.
Yes, I mean, I think we have to put it in perspective. I mean, we do get the genes that, you know, we get, and it is still true that if you want to know, well, the people used to say, if you want to know how long you're going to live, look at your parents and grandparents. At one level, that still works. But of course, whereas, you know, I mean, one of my grandmothers died at 73 and everyone said, oh, fantastic, you know, 3 score years and 10. Now we go 73. That's terrible. What happened? but on the whole, I mean, some people just have good genes. Some people come from very, very long lived families. You know, on my mother's side, you know, my grandparents and my mother and her three siblings all died in their early 90s. Just all got to their early 90s and died. It was extraordinary. And if I look at that family, that was a long-lived family. So on that side, I'm lucky. But, you know, there are many other people who don't have the genes. So but still, we can do something about our own personal longevity.
So what weighting would you put on the genetics? Because I have many people who come to me who say, yeah, my parents died in their mid to late 70s, and that's pretty much what I want to plan my finances for. You keep talking to age 90 or 100. That's way too long. I'm never going to last that. And actually, I've worked with some of these people. They've gone way beyond that life expectation. Yeah.
So basically, we can say that if you look at the health, I mean, this is just a mantra, but there is some scientific evidence behind it. If you look at the health status of a 70-year-old man today, it's very similar of that his father had at 50. And that is because his father probably smoked, drank a reasonable amount, and probably didn't have a very healthy lifestyle. Now, just because of increasing one's lifestyle, a 70-year-old, you know, do you know how many 70-year-old men and women there are jogging around Oxford? You know, even 10 years ago, you never saw that. Something as simple as the park run across the country has dramatically
Park run here.
Has dramatically increased our health. We are all aware of how we should be eating healthily. Having said that, we still have a very large group of the population who very, very sadly from very young years are obese. We have children who don't eat fruit and vegetables, sometimes not due to their own or their parents' fault, because we now know they will live in what we call a food desert, which means without a car, it's very difficult to get to somewhere that isn't a corner shop and just sells fizzy drinks and crisps. So we are getting and America is the same actually, but America and the UK suffers from this issue that we're getting a really divided health profile for our population. But for those people who I presume would tend to come and see you, yes, if your grandparents died in their late 70s, if you are, you know, educated and you've looked after yourself, then you are very likely to make it to your late 80s or even into your 90s. You know, that is the reality of the population today.
And they would have fewer years in chronic health if they're that educated, money behind them.
Yes. Yes. Yeah. I mean, there is an argument that most people do have a period of life where they do have some form of disability and frailty. Women tend to suffer from it more than men. I mean, a very interesting thing going back to smoking is that if you look at the data of death from lung cancer, cardiovascular disease and stroke in the 1980s, for men, it absolutely plummeted. And that's because we hit a generation that had given up or never taken up smoking. And it used to be that you saw that, you know, men died of a heart attack in their 50s and 60s and women became disabled and were susceptible to dementia in their 70s and 80s. That is no longer the case. You know, the gap is still there between men and women, but men who are living longer, you know, are fitter and healthier. It's women who still tend to suffer from frailty in later life. And part of that, I think, is to do with our anatomy. And we are more predisposed to Alzheimer's. Why that is, or forms of dementia, including vascular dementia, why that is unknown, except we now know, we've known for a long time, the link between diet, exercise, and our hearts. and we now are beginning to understand diet, exercise, and our brains. And I think maybe women have tended to be less active than men, both in their occupations and just generally in their lifestyles. And that will change because we now have many, many very healthy, active 40, 50, 60 year old women coming through.
Well, that's great. Sarah, I know we're coming up to time. You've got to go on to another meeting. What I think you've done there is answer the question that we had, which was, you know, should we be planning to the age that we're planning to? And we've got an argument for the pushback that you get from clients who...
I did have one question, but because you mentioned alcohol, and actually I'm quite partial to a glass of wine. Do I have to give that up?
Some of the most depressing seminars I ever have in Oxford is when people come and tell me the impact. We know that alcohol causes cancer. We know that alcohol is not good for us. And we also know that there is no minimum level of alcohol that is safe. And there has been a fantastic study which was done using the Chinese biobank. And the reason why this is important is that 70% of the Chinese have a gene that makes them feel ill if they drink alcohol. And as a consequence, they tend not to. And when they compared particularly the cancer risks between those with the gene and those not in the gene from the biobank's sample, there was a significant increase in cancer. Having said that,
this is what I'm waiting for.
All the seminar speakers that I speak to, I go, oh my goodness, does that mean you don't drink? And they go, of course we drink, but we drink in moderation. So I don't think anyone is, I haven't heard any public health message recently which says don't drink, but just be sensible and be aware of the risks.
Thank you for that.
And on that important note.
Very important note.
Sarah, thank you so much for joining us. It's been absolutely fascinating.
No, thank you. Thank you very much for your interest.